This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Lizzo, by many accounts, the artist of the moment. The flute-wielding singer and rapper secured the most 2020 Grammy nominations of any artist. Three of her eight are for the viral hit Truth Hurts.
Why men great till they gotta be great? Don't text me, tell it straight to my face. Best friend set me down in the salon chair. Shampoo press get you out of my hair. Fresh photos with the bomb lighting. New man on the Minnesota Vikings. True hurts needed something more exciting.
Lizzo has garnered fame for her charismatic and wild performances, catchy beats, and unapologetic embrace of her body. But it is that last part that some critics don't like. A celebrity trainer and a prominent social commentator both recently attacked her size. What's behind the body shaming? One of the many topics we'll talk about today in this episode of Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll review the HBO series Watchmen, the film Queen and Slim, and the new Prince memoir. And joining me for all of that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Also an author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome to both of you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing well. Let's start out by talking about these recent attacks on Lizzo. So here's a clip from fitness trainer Jillian Michaels during a BuzzFeed News morning show last week.
Why are we celebrating her body? Why does it matter? That's what I'm saying. Like, why aren't we celebrating her music? Because it isn't going to be awesome if she gets diabetes.
Well, I want to ask you.
I'm just being honest. Like, I love her music. Like, my kid loves her music. But there's never a moment where I'm like, and I'm so glad that she's overweight. Like, why do I even care? Like, why is it my job to care about her weight?
That's fitness trainer Jillian Michaels on BuzzFeed News morning show last week. And I'm here with Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So, Natalie, what's your reaction?
Well, I think Jillian Michaels is just, she's clueless. I mean, she's not aware because she didn't really have to be. About the ways that just about everything she says about Lizzo in that bite is problematic. Instead of looking at Lizzo as overweight, you know, because there are plenty of people that, like, our body types are all over the map, right? But I think Jillian's former co-host from The Biggest Loser, what's his name, Bob, I can't remember his name, but, you know, he had a heart attack at 52, and he has no body fat, right? So what are we talking about, really?
Yeah, but isn't she trying to say here, I don't care about her weight, so why are you making me? Why is that? What I hear
but
her
she
saying
does
is,
care.
Why is everybody talking about the fact that she's really good for a big-bodied woman?
I think that's the qualification that Jillian is making. Mm-hmm. I think that's what she's hearing, because I don't think anybody is saying that Lizzo is good. I think most people who are truly fans of Lizzo and get it are not saying she's good for a big woman. Right. They're saying that she's awesome. And part of the reason why she's awesome is because she does not care. She's unapologetic about her size. And we all know that in our culture, big women, especially big black women, who twerk and who wear whatever they want and reveal all kind of parts of their bodies are not celebrated. So Jillian is it really what she's saying when she says, why should we celebrate the fact that she's overweight? She's saying, I don't understand why we would celebrate someone who's fat or who we in our culture think is fat. And she's just not getting the fact that she's fat shaming her and body shaming her. And that is what happens typically to black women.
Mark?
So it's an interesting discussion, right? So on the one hand, Michaels gives us a kind of white gaze conversation on this, right, which obviously brings race into it. But we're also hearing the same conversations within black spaces, right? So when you have someone like Boyce Watkins, who is as much commenting on her body type as he is her performance of that body type in white spaces when he refers to her as performing mammyisms, right, in front of white people, you realize the way in which Lizzo is disrupting certain kinds of narratives. Now, you know, from a historical standpoint, and you think about the history of black music, you know, you can think about examples of Mahalia Jackson or Big Maybelle, Ella Fitzgerald, right? You can think about Solomon Burke, right? You know, who used to actually come down here to Durham, you know, to the Duke Clinic, right, to deal with his overweightness, deal with Luther Vandross, right? So in some levels, there's a kind of tradition around this. I think now we're at a moment where body shaming is so pronounced and so public and so visible that when you see someone like Lizzo who's able to claim her body and own it for its beauty and actually create a space where other folks can now be open about the fact that they actually find that body type desirable, right? It's a different kind of conversation. You know, my qualms with Lizzo is that I don't necessarily get the music, right? Because there's a lot of the music that feels just like a novelty to me, right? And that's not a comment on her talent, right? Because we know she plays classical instruments and incredible talent, but the music package sounds like a novelty that I'm not sure we're going to be listening to 10 years from now, and I'm not so sure deserved the number of nominations that it got.
Well, that gets
us to... And that's a separate discussion.
But it's back to the same point, is that do you have to have the discussion about, in other words, a little bit of what, you know, Jillian is trying to say is, could I just talk about her music? Could we not talk about her weight? But maybe you're in a moment where, because of the standard that we hold, we have, and because of her public embrace of her body shape and body type, first we have to have the discussion, then maybe someday when you just go ahead and sing the song.
And this is the thing, where the music industry is today, where they sign folks based on their number of Instagram followers, the other story comes always before the music now. The music is secondary in how they market everybody at this moment.
Well, Lizzo made a name for herself because of her music, but also because of her vulnerability and openness. She is in that point where you've got to talk about it. And when it comes to talking about her relationship with her body, let's listen to a clip of her talking about that in an interview last year.
It doesn't matter how small or big, or how I look, no one's ever going to be completely happy with it. I'm not going to be able to please everybody with my outward appearance. Someone's always going to have a critique. Someone's always going to have some negativity to say about me. So it, all that matters is what I think about it. And I had to go so deep inside myself and look in the mirror. Like, looking in the mirror and accepting what's in the mirror is very, very difficult. And right now, I love every time I look in the mirror. So, like, I have to go back and remember those days where I would look in the mirror and just be like, wow. I would remember being like, I just want to cut my stomach off and throw it. Why can't I just cut it off? And, man, I'm so glad I didn't.
This is the artist Lizzo talking with actress Jameela Jamil for an interview series called I Weigh, and I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So you were about to say something, I think, before that clip.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like as I don't know that we can really separate Lizzo's acceptance of her body, her love for herself, from her music, because I feel like it's all intertwined. So I think that's a part of what is disturbing about what Jillian Michaels is saying, because she's talking about being a fan of Lizzo, but she that's the part she doesn't get, that that if you're a fan of Lizzo, you understand that her her body acceptance is infused in her music. And also, I mean, like, the reality is, ain't nobody happy with their body. Ain't nobody. There is nobody, and especially women, because of how our culture objectifies, hypersexualizes, especially black women, right? So when Lizzo talks about wanting to cut her stomach off and throw it, hello? Yeah, I've wanted to do that as well. So there's a way that she, by having this conversation, if it's just by being present in the way that she is in our culture, she allows the rest of us to kind of, you know, accept ourselves as well. And I think that that's incredibly important.
Big part of the story. Let's talk about some of the other 2020 Grammy nominations. There were others. Mark, tell us about your pick.
Georgia Ann Muldrow, I'm so happy that she got a nomination. I mean, she's been doing this for 15 years, L.A.-based artist. Her father was the jazz musician Roland Muldrow. Mm-hmm. And so she and her husband, Dudley Perkins, basically for the last 15 years have been creating and crafting this unique sound that borrows from funk, borrows from jazz, very much hip-hop in the same context. And so I'm just happy that someone who has toiled in the underground, you know, she's not signed to a major label, but someone who has toiled in the underground as long as she has, finally gets to see, you know, some shine on her work.
Let's hear a little bit of her music.
How much we gotta grow before we can learn to defend ourselves? How much we gotta know that we can depend on no one else?
I don't even know no more.
Jazz singer Georgia Ann Muldrow singing Blam from her latest album, Overload, nominated for Best Urban Contemporary Album. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. I've got a short version. We can talk a little bit more about it. But Natalie, briefly tell us about your pick.
So Jasmia is kind of on the other side of Georgia Ann Muldrow. She hasn't been toiling for a very long time at all. But this is her second Grammy nomination. Her first nomination was as a result of her first album. Mm-hmm. So she is, I think what I love about Jasmia is she's pointing the way. She is like a vision of where jazz can go and the fact that it's still very much alive. But she also is infusing what is very Betty Carter-ish with her own, you know, personality and vibe, and it works, and it's beautiful, and it's powerful, and I just love her music.
Let's listen into some of that as we close out this segment of Back Channel. We'll be back right after this.
I got like me, but he was too scared. I kept prancing and hoping he would like the moves I made, but he never noticed. Now I know to find my true love. I keep on trying, but time is flying.
This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When the 33-year-old Los Angeles rapper Nipsey Hussle was fatally shot last year, grief surged through the hip-hop community. Murals popped up around the country, and fans took to the streets and social media to share his legacy. One Wisconsin-based fan circulated a meme listing all the books that Nipsey had talked about, and that meme has since become a movement. Groups of fans now gather in book clubs around the country and talk about the text that inspired this artist. We're talking about that today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, tell us more about these texts that we're talking about in the book clubs.
So Simran Kalika, who's a lawyer from Wisconsin, many of Nipsey Hussle's many fans, you know, followed him and knew that he was a reader and decided to do a meme on Instagram and Twitter of all these books that, you know, he was reading. And folks just gravitated to it. And so what we've seen are these pockets around the country of largely African-American men, you know, who started reading the books that Nipsey was reading. And it's fascinating because, you know, on the one hand, we know that Black folks weren't allowed to actually read for a long time. Mm-hmm. The publishing company liked to believe that Black folks wouldn't read. Mm. Then we only believed that the only people who were reading were Black women writers writing fiction. And so we've always kind of gone to the assumption that young Black men don't read. These book clubs suggest something very different. And the kinds of books that he's reading, you know, kind of speaks to where his mind is. Some of the most well-known books, George Jackson's Blood in My Eye, you know, George Jackson, who was on the periphery of the Black Panther Party and was very much this kind of icon of the late 1960s. In fact, he was in a relationship with Angela Davis. You know, she went to jail basically or was on the run for so long because she was accused of sending guns to George Jackson and his brother Jonathan. But also Sam Greeley's The Spook Who Sat Beside the Door, you know, which was a novel and then a film that was in, you know, the theaters for a week back in 1973. So it was like this combination of Black political power, some conspiracy theory, but the kind of stuff that you could imagine young readers who were listening to Nipsey right, and talking about many of these same themes would be drawn to some of his books.
Yeah, well, here he is just talking about some of the books that interested him. This is an interview from 2013.
I just read things I was interested in. You know, I started off reading magazines. You know what I mean? That's how I learned about hip-hop culture outside of L.A.
Right.
By reading, like, XXL and The Source, hearing about classic albums from other places and all that.
Right.
And then, like, anything I was interested in, I read the magazines about it.
Right.
And I just start getting the books. And just like you said, a lot of my best ideas, a lot of my business savvy, which I ain't the smartest dude, but I know what I know, you know, came from books. Like, I read books about the industry. I read books about the deals that was done in the industry.
Right.
And these dudes, you know, held out and made certain decisions that empowered them for the rest of their career.
And there it is, the now deceased rapper Nipsey Hussle talking in an interview on Hood Rich Radio in 2013, talking about Nipsey's legacy with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie?
I think one of the things that just continues to touch me is what one LA Times writer calls the Nipsey Hussle effect. And what Mark described in terms of this Twitter post that lists all of his books. I mean, that's a part of the effect that he was so beloved, you know, for the way that he thought about his community, loved his community, the things he was trying to do. And I mean, there are some incredible, what are they? They're like infographics, but it's a more complicated word than that. But that basically show all the things he had his hand in that he was trying to do at the time of his death. Like, so he was serious. And then to see that, you know, he really educated himself through these books that he was reading. I think part of it is inspiration because young people are wanting to do something similar. There's this brilliance about Nipsey in that, you know, some of these titles that he was reading, they ain't easy, you know, but he was really hungry. I think he was hungry for something that is much more lasting than fame. And I think he actually found it. I mean, his death, unfortunately, in many ways, he has transcended even what he did, right, while he was alive. And I think that effect is going to continue. And this is just a beautiful part of it.
You know, when Nipsey Hussle was first killed, there were a lot of folks who made comparisons to him and Tupac Shakur.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of people pushed back because the body of work wasn't there. And there were folks who still really didn't even know who Nipsey Hussle was. But the irony is that when Tupac got killed, the same kind of conversation was erected around his own reading list, right? Mm-hmm. And, of course, he had someone like Leila Steinberg, who was a mentor of his for a while, who could actually tell the world, well, Tupac was reading this, Tupac was reading that. I think about a story, you know, Michael Eric Dyson, who wrote an obituary in Nipsey Hussle in the New York Times, you know, he talked about the fact that the first time he met Nipsey Hussle on a flight from New York to L.A., they were sitting next to each other, and the conversation started with, I've been reading your books.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hussle,
mm-hmm.
Nipsey Hussle talking about Mike Eric Dyson, and end up having this rich conversation about the kinds of books that they were reading. We're still very much and have always been a reading culture, and even the hip-hop generation is still as invested in that as every other generation.
Yeah, and I think that's a part of what is really revealing, or not revealing, but it sort of flies in the face of what people typically think, not only about black men in general, but a type of black man, right? Who would think, right, that Nipsey Hussle would be this avid, prolific reader and reading stuff that is like serious, you know, and I just, it's that effect.
Let's talk now about the HBO series Watchmen, created by Damon Lindelof, and it reframes a universe from the hit 1980s comic series of the same name. Let's start with a clip from the trailer.
Cavalry has our names and addresses.
Just run and scared.
Are we safe, Angela?
Each place we go.
There's a vast and insidious conspiracy. If I told you about it, your head would explode.
Just run and scared.
What is this?
This is the only way to show you the truth.
You need to help stop the 7th Cavalry.
From doing what?
Those f***ers are trying to start a war.
Clip of the trailer of the HBO series Watchmen, created by Damon Lindelof. And it continues the late 80s DC comic series of the same name. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, set up the series for us, this world that it creates. Natalie?
So Watchmen, as you said, it's really kind of, it's not a spinoff, but it kind of continues where this DC comic left off. Mm. You know what? I mean, first episode that I watched, I was like, what in the world is going on? Like, what is happening up in here? Because there is
Let me stop you there. Were you familiar with the graphic
novel? No. And okay. So maybe that's part of it, because I had to turn to friends like my dear friend Milton Tucker and be like, what is going on? You know, and he was like, okay, 1980s, 2009 movie. But, I mean, I think the thing that people have to catch about Watchmen is that it sort of, the ending is the beginning. Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on, but it is so, I think, incredibly woven together and creates this rich universe of characters, led by a black woman, Regina King, who is so good in this series. Essentially, we're talking about a contemporary Tulsa, Oklahoma, that is sort of, in many ways, reeling from the results of the Tulsa race riot of 1921, I think it was. And so there's a whole bunch of like mystery and intrigue that's going on with Regina's character, but also the way that like law enforcement is configured, like it, race and gender and just power, like all these different themes are played out in this incredible way. And it's just riveting, not to mention the fact that it is just so creative, just beautifully shot, artistically. I mean, it's just amazing.
America always has had a blind spot around Black history. And if there's a moment to be said, something to be said about, you know, the contemporary moving image, the Academy Award nominations notwithstanding, is that folks now have a freedom to tell some stories that they hadn't been told before. I would imagine that most Americans were introduced to the Tulsa race riots on the debut of The Watchmen than had ever heard about it before.
Right.
And even those folks who knew about it had never really seen it visualized to the extent that it was.
But we knew what it was.
Right, we knew what it was, right? As soon as you saw it, it's like Tulsa 1921,
exactly.
Oh, we know exactly what this is. And so the risk-taking of grounding a whole season in that story, you know, speaks to where people are, right? And, you know, some of it, as we talked about, is about money, right? We could create some fresh new lane for something. Folks are going to watch it or generate some money. But if it's done really, really well, as this is the case, you know, it's a chance to tell some marvelous stories. And, you know, and the irony again, you know, a month or 2 months after the debut, you know, they find this mass gravesite of bodies that were likely killed, right, in the 1921 Tulsa race riots and removed someplace far from the city no one had to pay attention to it. So again, like the series itself, it's contemporary news.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but interestingly enough, this series does take on race in a very self-conscious, very centered way, in a way that the original graphic novel did not. I mean, not that it sidestepped it, but it was much more concerned with political power writ large and institutional
Vietnam
power.
Vietnam War, Nixon.
And Nixon, right. And this really does center on race and stories that are not necessarily untold, but certainly unknown in the American public. Right. So here's Damon Lindelof, the creator, talking about that kind of decision.
This idea that Watchmen has always been about the history that has been kind of hidden and camouflaged, and also it's about the pain and trauma that is sort of buried in the American consciousness. And I started to feel like it was incredibly important to tell a story about race, to not tell a story about race in the context of a political text in 2019 almost felt borderline irresponsible.
Damon Lindelof, who is the creator of the HBO series Watchmen, talking on Morning Edition in October. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And Natalie, you were talking about Academy Award-winning actress Regina King and her performance and central role in this series. I want to listen to a clip of her talking about her character and being in the show, in which she and many others were often wearing masks.
Angela Abar is who I play. To me, she kind of represents all of us in the way I say that, because in the first episode, you get to see three different masks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of how we move in real life.
To the
you
world.
Know, who we are at the family reunion is different than who we are at home with the immediate family.
Yeah, than who we are at work.
Than who we are at work.
That boss that gets on our nerves.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
You know, so we're always constantly changing masks. And sometimes we get confused on which one we should have on.
Oof.
Through Angela, we kind of explore all of that through Angela, through story.
Actress Regina King talking with NPR's Sam Sanders about her role in the HBO series Watchmen. And Natalie, you talked about that powerful performance and how important it was for you to see her in that role.
Yeah, I mean, yes, because she's the heroine. I mean, she's the super heroine, really, of the piece. You know, this idea of masks, I think, is something that is really interesting, and that certainly does, you know, provide like this running dialogue throughout the series. And at one point, the man who ends up being Angela's grandfather, who actually as a young boy escaped the Tulsa race riots, you know, when he's about her age, he says in a flashback, you know, that masks are not, no, it's her father, sorry, her father says this, that masks are not good because, you know, people are hiding, you don't really know who they are, you don't know where they're coming from, and then she grows up to be someone who wears all these different masks. I think the mask theme is so appropriate for the way that race is talked about, not only in the specificity of this race riot, because there are actually white men in masks shooting people, right? But in the contemporary time, I mean, if we think about our current politics, how many masks are folk wearing right now, right? How many different types of personas are sort of circulating? On the one hand, I know and I believe, although I don't know it, definitely, but I believe that there were quite a few Black folks in the writer's room for this series. But I think that there is, you know, also something about the fact that Lindelof is a white dude, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Who, I'm not sure. I mean, in this day and age, maybe, but I think there is something about him taking this on that allows for a landscape through which we can have these conversations. And the fact that, thank God, he was progressive enough to have all of these, this diversity of characters, and to have a Black man who looks like a god play Dr. Manhattan, y'all gotta watch it. You know, that's all I gotta say. But to have that is, you know, there's something cooking here. So I'm really looking forward to the second season.
Let's turn now to the new drama thriller Queen and Slim. Premises that a Black couple goes on the run after a routine traffic stop. Something goes wrong, they kill a white cop in self-defense, and we can listen to a clip of the trailer.
Get on the ground! Keep your hands where I can see
you! Why is he under arrest? What is your badge number?
Chill, just chill!
I'm reaching for my cell phone! Ah!
That's a little bit of the trailer from the movie Queen and Slim, written by Lena Waithe. I'm talking about that with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, tell us more about this one.
Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless meets Black Lives Matter. and that's the only way to describe it. It is a film about a random police stop that obviously goes wrong. And, you know, we basically watch this couple, a la Thelma and Louise, you know, a la Bonnie and Clyde, you know, which was inspired by Godard's, you know, Breathless, you know, on the run, right? And from an audience standpoint, it allows you to kind of connect with them and hope that they get away. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about the film. I don't want to throw any spoilers out there about the ending of it. But, you know, there's a way in which folks are looking for a win, you know, at the end of the film. And a lot of folks upset because there wasn't a win. But, you know, when you watch the film in the movie theaters, when the police officer who gets shot is shot early in the film, for all intents and purposes, that's the win, right? Mm-hmm. And there are folks in the audience going, we finally got one, right? As one example right. of that. It is a very complicated film. And, you know, it was directed by Melina Moustakis, who's worked very closely with Beyonce and Solange Knowles. There's an art school feel to it, you know, which is why I think the Breathless reference, you know, makes so much sense. But it is a contemporary, you know, runaway slave narrative that tries to capture as much as possible about the, you know, the sweetness of Black life for a couple that's out on their first date.
And the Bonnie and Clyde reference, too, it's actually referenced in the film, then there's a question about whether or not, you know, Bonnie and Clyde actually committed crimes, and this was a kind of crime of self-defense, but it's got a lot of certainly parallels.
I think that Queen and Slim does not get made without the type of writing that comes from someone like Lena Waithe. And I love the story that she tells about how it was actually a white exec, you know, approached her about the story that he had come up with, but that he knew he could not write. Now, how about that? You know, especially in the age of Oscar's So White, you know, that a white person who had the power to actually tell the story and do with it whatever he wanted to, that he had the understanding to approach someone like Lena Waithe, I think it speaks volumes. And although I will say I did not get to see it yet, I do think that it is important for that reason, because it is not often that Black people, let alone Black women, get to write films like this that, from everything that I'm hearing and seeing and watching, is so saturated with Blackness and is really the type of films like that I wish we could see more of.
Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies. It's Back Channel. Coming up, we will review the Prince memoir on the state of things, the beautiful ones. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel Today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. We want to start the conversation in this segment about Prince's new memoir, The Beautiful Ones, co-written and edited by writer Dan Pipenbring. Natalie, tell us a little bit about this book. Prince was on the way to writing a memoir, but it had to be finished because of his untimely death.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful. It's aptly titled.
Yeah.
You know, if you are someone who has been a Prince fan since you were a teenager, like me, and you've sort of followed his trajectory, right? You know, one of the things that I appreciate about Prince as I've gotten older is that I've begun to realize, and The Beautiful Ones confirms it, that he's deeply philosophical. Like the truth-telling that he does in music. I used to think, you know, oh, he's so raunchy, he's so honest, you know, he's so dirty and all that. But Prince is really, I think he was really trying to get at truth more so than trying to titillate. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a difference. And The Beautiful Ones really sort of creates this picture of a man who was seeking, you know, sort of like, well, like most of our great artists. They're always striving to figure out, you know, some new question that they've posed for, usually for themselves. But they're always pushing the envelope. And that's what I get from The Beautiful Ones, that he was someone who was not content with, you know, just kind of riding out the rest of his career on the strength of what he'd already done. You know, he was experimenting. He had, I think right before he died, he had just done the piano and a guitar. There was, or a piano and a microphone. There was a tour that he was doing, which was very intimate.
Yeah.
You know, and Prince can do that, right? Because he's that talented. But he wasn't, he was making very intentional choices is what I'd like to say about it. And I just really appreciate something like that that gives me an insight, gives fans insight into this, the interior life of someone like Prince.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about Prince himself getting into the music business. You sort of think, well, what else could he do? Well, it's kind of interesting. Here he is talking about in 1991... on the Arsenio Hall show, and the question is, you know, sort of how'd you get into music?
When I was 16, I was completely broke and needed to go get a job, so I got the Yellow Pages out and I couldn't find one thing that I wanted to do. So I decided I was going to push as hard as I could to be a musician and win at it, you know.
It's Prince in 1991 on the Arsenio Hall show talking about his life. The new memoir was co-written by writer Dan Pipenbring. It's called The Beautiful Ones, and we're talking about it with Natalie Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And Prince describes Mark growing up in Minneapolis and about his early performances. You know, there's a lot in this that we can learn, really use to learn about Prince.
You know, the thing about this book, you know, Prince throughout his career was very impressionistic around his autobiography. Right, he told different pieces mm-hmm. of his history and mm-hmm. colored it a lot. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, in the absence of a full autobiography, right, what we have is actually a book that's very impressionistic. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking maybe 3 dozen pages are actually prints, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. you know, and you get a reproduction of it handwritten, mm-hmm. so you get a right. sense about his handwriting and things like that. You know, a lot of it is the way that Pipenbring was able to pull together these conversations.
Yeah.
And I think it still works in that regard, right? But again, as if you're a fan of Prince, what other kind of memoir would you get? Mm-hmm. Right? You were never going to get a tell-all memoir
right.
from Prince.
Right.
So this works very much in the spirit of who Prince was. It's also an interesting moment around, you know, these particular iconic black male figures. You know, we did get a memoir of Michael Jackson moonwalking when he was younger, right? It'd been right. interesting to see what that looks like now. But when you consider Dyson's book on Jay-Z, the book that Bakari Kitwana has just done with Rakim, you know, you have these three kind of iconic black male musical figures from the 80s and the 90s who represented certain kinds of brands. And in some ways, the books are offering a kind of revision of, mm-hmm. of who we thought they actually were mm-hmm. in the beginning. And of course, most pronounced in that case is Prince.
Yeah, and with Prince, it's so difficult because, again, as you point out, Mark, I mean, who was that guy? You
right.
know, with all
right.
that performance, this is a genius in American, in the world of music. There are few geniuses like
right.
him. And yet there's all this kind of pyrotechnics that makes him sort of such a tawdry pop star that you think, for years, I couldn't get near the guy just because I thought, well, that's not for
right.
me. I don't listen to that kind of thing. And then I started listening. I said, well, what's with all the costumes?
And we still don't know what he eats for breakfast.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
But, I mean, to Mark's point about Prince being, or the autobiography, or the biography, really, being impressionistic. Yes, I think that that's true. But I think there is a way that there is something about the book, and even though in most of the instances it's coming from Pipenbring, that we're able to get some insight into, you know, I mean, to me, what I learn about Prince, even if it is sort of opaque, helps me to understand his music better. I feel like I get some insight into why he's saying, why he even came up with a song called The Beautiful Ones, or what he might have been referring to, you know, in Soft and Wet. Like, you know, it's not just about sex, you know, like for one topic, in one instance. I mean, he was really talking about, I think he was interested in, even if he wasn't really trying to talk to the rest of us in like right. stark terms about it, he was interested in people and connection and in the things that really make life what it is. And I think that you get a sense of that in The Beautiful Ones.
Well, let's turn now to The Godfather of Harlem, a crime drama TV series on Epix that reimagines the story of infamous crime boss Bumpy Johnson, played by Forrest Whitaker. Let's listen to a bit of the trailer.
More heroin comes out of these project towers than any other place in Harlem.
Wouldn't like this when I went away. Shutting down drug corners is the nation's cause. I got guns. I got soldiers.
Bumpy Johnson, he's playing all of us.
Harlem is a tinderbox. It's about to explode.
You're gonna have a serious problem on your hands.
What is that, a threat?
Hallelujah, I maneuver, I'm the driver and the shooter.
I can't control the streets without drugs.
Where will it end?
Clip from the crime drama TV series Godfather of Harlem on Epix, talking about it with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, tell us more about Bumpy Johnson.
So Bumpy Johnson, you know, was a Harlem gangster, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. He was close with and at least worked under the five Italian crime families in New York during that period of time. But he, you know, he was a legend in that kind of context, right? And so Godfather of Harlem tells his story, you know, after he returns from prison in 63. And Harlem in 1963 is an interesting place. This is the height of Adam Clayton Powell's Jr.'s moment. Malcolm X is there. So the series reimagines, and not so much reimagining. You know, Bumpy Johnson and Detroit Red at the time, they knew each other. All these folks knew Adam Clayton Powell. So it's kind of a salacious historical fiction about what relationships were and could have been, you know, between, first of all, those three men, but also these crime families that are on the periphery of all this stuff in Harlem in the 1960s. And it's a moment in which folks are now taking a kind of interest in. You know, Kemp Powers did a play called One Night in Miami, which is about the actual relationship between Ali and Sam Cooke and Malcolm X and Jim Brown. And it's actually being turned into a film now that's being directed by Regina King. Mm-hmm. So there's, again, this moment now to go back and deal with Black historical fiction in ways that the story couldn't have been told, you know, 20, 40 or 30 years ago.
And to that point, you know, I read something that, you know, really kind of put Godfather of Harlem in sort of a historical context, because you know, if you think about it, so we had, the name of the nightclub?
Cotton Club.
The Cotton Club. Yeah. So there's the Cotton Club that comes out, and it kind of skirts around the, actually, I think.
Fishburne does play
Bumpy.
Bumpy in Cotton Club.
In Cotton Club. But then, and then you get the film Life with Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence, and there is a Bumpy-ish character in that. And I think there's one other.
Well, the big one is American Gangster.
American Gangster, right.
Because he was a mentor to Frank Lucas, right, who's the subject of American Gangster.
Yes, yes. And so it's interesting that now here we have this series that squarely focuses on the life of the actual man, and it's not like, it's not, I mean, of course, in many ways it's fictitious. It is focusing on this man's life in a way that it hasn't been focused on before.
The other interesting thing, and going back to Queen and Slim, too, is the way that Americans have, over time, glorified, glamorized, and romanticized certain kinds of criminal life, right? The Godfather, Italian crime families. These are glamorous. Bonnie and Clyde were poor white people who were the heroes in that story, right? We got mad when they shot them to death. Then comes the 70s when that little genealogy, right, when it was time to hand the baton to African-American crime leaders from the Italian crime leaders, and all of a sudden it was three strikes, you're out, and zero tolerance policies. Right. And it was far less romantic and a lot less glamorous in American public opinion.
You know, the thing about Godfather of Harlem, and it, you know, it's so well acted. You know, Giancarlo Esposito was brilliant as Adam Clayton Powell, you know, as is Forrest Whitaker, you know, as Bumpy Johnson. But there's a way in which you could imagine to get this done. You know, you spend as much time trying to figure out the five crime families, you know, as you do trying to figure out who these actual Black historical figures are.
Let's turn now to the last topic, internationally co-produced supernatural drama, Atlantics, directed by Mati Diop. She made history this year when she became the first Black female director considered for the highest prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Set up the premise for us, Mark.
So it's a, you know, it's a ghost story, right? It's a duppy. It's a duppy narrative. You know, it's dealing with global capital. You have Dakar, and there's this huge skyscraper that's like just out of place. And the workers who work on it don't get paid. Mm. And so they realize they got to try to find money someplace else. So they hop on a boat to go to Spain, right, to get another job. And they're lost at sea. And their ghost come back, you know, basically taking on the bodies of the women that they were with to demand their money back. And that's one part of the story. The other part of the story is this love story between one of the men who leaves and a young woman who's always been promised to another man, right? And her working through the narrative between the man that she loves that she lost and this man who she's promised to in marriage.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. You know, one of the things that I love about foreign films is that it forces you to pay attention to things other than dialogue, right? And also foreign films have a way of like really sort of celebrating the intelligence of viewers. And so instead of always giving you these musical cues to let you know you're supposed to be scared now and you're supposed to be anxious now. Yeah. I think Atlantics, you know, has this beautiful musical landscape. Mm. But then the cinematography, I think, is also just incredible. And one of the things, I mean, you know, Mark talked about the men that go out and are lost at sea, the love story. But then the sea, I mean, the ocean, Atlantic Ocean itself is a character, I think, because we keep going back to the ocean. The ocean is ever present. It is, you know, basically in the lives. It's always in the background of what's going on. And, you know, at times we can see that it's angry. At times we can see that it's very calm and beautiful. But I was so impressed by the way that this, you know, very animated but inanimate, you know, piece of nature is woven into this story. You know, it was just really, really well told. It's something that I wish more people would have the chance to see.
Well, it's a feature film now, but in some ways it started out, the germ of this started out as a documentary. And here's Mahdi Diop talking about the film Atlantics as it is now.
I wanted the film to capture both the period where a lot of young people lost their lives in the ocean and also this emergence of a new voice. And I wanted to capture that into these two energies, into one single film. And this emergence of a new generation holding their story got embodied by this young woman who I wanted to tell the story of her own spring from teenager to a woman.
Director Mahdi Diop talking during a director's dialogue, in fact, during the New York Film Festival at the Lincoln Center, talking about her award-winning film Atlantics, now streaming on Netflix. And Mark, talk about, I mean, there is this supernatural quality to it, right? I mean, it's this feature film based on things that were actually happening out of Senegal initially, and then it takes on this kind of supernatural cast.
Absolutely. You know, in one hand, it's, you know, how do you tell a story about a country where many of the folks there, you know, practice Islam? Right. And try to tell that story or to understand a culture where, you know, men might take on multiple wives and you get promised to someone. Right. And there's this great moment in the film, you know, where she has this love for this working class guy who literally is broke. And, you know, her mother or her grandmother says to her, you know, most women would love to have what you have in this man that you're promised to. And
times are tough.
You know, and the times are tough. But when you see the two of them together, you realize there's nothing there.
Yeah.
You know, he looks like he's much older than she is. There's no connection. And her real love, you know, and again, no spoilers, the end of the film, the beautiful, most beautiful part of the film, you know, is the time that they get to come back together after all of this drama has occurred.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to Back Channel on the State of Things, a program produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon. Jenny Lawson's our technical director, Josie Taras, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.